You're listening to another top-rated radio show on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Welcome to the American Hour with your host, Commander Tom Garcia, on the USA Talk Radio Network.
And of course, our lovely co-host, Paula Lauzon. This is the American Hour. I am Commander Tom Garcia. Welcome tonight. Paula, how are you doing? Oh, we got to turn your mic on. I don't know why that happens sometimes. These things happen. And of course, there we go. Is your mic working now? Oh, all right, Paula, I'm going to let you turn your mic on because I probably clicked it at the same time you did. In any case, we got a great show for you. If you missed our show last night, a lot of stuff about the Supreme Court discussion, the Supreme Court themselves. We had a lot of sound bites, a lot of audio bites, and maybe actually Paula can't turn it on because she might be calling in remotely. So I clicked on it again. Let's see if we can get your mic to come up and stay up. Darn it. There. Oh, gosh. I don't know what the problem is, Paula, but I can't get your mic to stay on. Give me a second. And, in fact, if I have to, I'll call you because it may be from wherever you're calling in. I'll try it one more time. But in any case, we had a great discussion last night about the Supreme Court, what the justices themselves were asking. And I've dug and come up with a bunch more audio bites. Yeah, Paula, it's for some reason it is not – keeping you on, so I'm going to give you a call, and hopefully I can get you up that way. Let me find your phone number, and then we'll just dial it right in. All right. Well, I see your phone number right there. I'm going to have to hang up on you, Paul. I hate to do that, but I'm going to hang up on you, and then I'm going to dial you directly, and we'll see if this works. So, okay, everybody want to know Paula's phone number? No, I'm not going to do that. All right, here we go. We'll hear it ring. We should hear it ring. There we go. Isn't that cool? You call people on the radio, from the radio. Maybe she's having some trouble with her cell phone. Oh, she just called in on another. There we go. Paula, can you hear me?
Sorry. I don't know what happened. Technical glitch.
All right. That's okay. I tried dialing it myself, and it was ringing, but maybe you weren't hearing it because you were calling back. I had to hang up on you because I couldn't get the microphone to stay on. Anyways, yeah, hey, those things happen, you know. It's a beautiful thing. If you haven't listened to the show before, I've broadcast from everywhere from Madrid, Spain, Brazil, Sao Paulo, Brazil, Rio, Brazil, Santiago, Chile, and a bunch of other places. I think we even did a show once from Kingston, Jamaica, man. And that was a fun show, yeah. So we do that. We haven't broadcast remotely in some time, but we may be doing that a bit next month because I've got a little bit different flying schedule than usual. In any case, great show last night. Lots of good audio bites. And what I did was I placed a link on the website, actually on Facebook. I didn't do it on the website. There's just so much stuff on the website. But on Facebook, go to the American Hour Radio Show. And there's a link. You got to scroll down a little bit because I put some other stuff up there today. But a link to the majority of the audio bites. So if you want to review those, they're right there. But we've got more tonight. Oh, Paula, did I find some gems, some good stuff that you're not going to get in the mainstream media. You're not going to get on Fox News. You're not going to get anywhere, along with some very wonderful insight from Paula and myself. And the whole thing is going to culminate with my soundbite called Opening a Can of Worms. I think Chief Justice Roberts gave one of the best explanations. And in fact, I wrote an article. When did I write this article? Back about maybe a year ago, that really outlines what he's talking about, but in a fictional sense. Like, here's where this could go, okay? And you're going to, and if we get a chance, I'm going to read some of that because it's really good, and it highlights what the justices were talking about, but in a way that I think everybody can really, truly understand. But I've tried to get sound bites that are easiest to understand, don't get too technical. And I've even got a couple sound bites, Paula, that after the justices were questioning the lawyer for the government, then the plaintiffs, the lawyer who I guess was representing the state, got asked some questions, and they were going round and round and round about by the liberal judges who clearly want this to happen. And I think he gave some very good answers. And then he'll give you some more insight into why they're thinking they can get away with this. So in any case, before we get into that, I want to mention a couple things. The NVHS, National Veterans Homeless Support, has got a dinner, their annual dinner on the 7th of April in Viera, Florida. I put a link on the website. Go to usaradionetwork.com, usaradionetwork.com. Go to the American Hour page, and you might have to scroll down just a little bit, but there's the logo and their annual dinner, and I've got a link to their Facebook page that gives you all the information about their annual dinner. And it is, oh, gosh, I can't remember what the name of the comment. Factors of Success or some such thing, but it's honoring various people throughout the state who have made a big difference on veterans in the state of Florida, who have had big impact and made a difference for veterans. So it's going to be some politicians, it's going to be some members of the American Legion, members of the VFW. So big dinner. If you can make it to that, please go, because you'll be helping support the NVHS. All proceeds go to the veterans. Now, speaking of veterans, Paula, very disturbing article today in the American Spectator. You've heard me talk about this in the past, and I sent you a link to it. I don't know if you read it or not. I know you got a busy day. Obama's broken promise to wounded warriors. It's not just Obama. It's the Defense Department. It's many of our politicians, including Republicans. But he is the commander-in-chief, and so the buck is going to stop there. But I just do want to say this. I've been talking about it for years and pointing out those individuals, from John McCain to Lindsey Graham to the Undersecretary of the Veterans Administration and on, people who are casting our wounded warriors aside. And this article goes into great depth of precisely how this is going to happen, and I would just want to cover a couple of the highlights here. For most Americans who oppose, and this is written by Robert Goldberg, actually did come out today. It came out 2 days ago. For most of Americans who oppose Obamacare, the constitutionality of the law's mandate to buy insurance is less important than the power government has under the law to rob them of medical freedom. Ironically, those that lose freedom under Obamacare first could be wounded warriors who fought for our freedom. In 2010, President Obama promised Obamacare wouldn't diminish health benefits for service families or retirees. Not true. Pinocchio, your nose is growing. And I'm not going to read you his quote because it's just disgusting, but that's what he said. That's a summarization. Last week, the administration unveiled a plan to remake TRICARE. That's what active duty service members use to provide health care for their families, even themselves, outside of a military clinic or hospital, as well as retirees. And this article says that this remake breaks his promise that he made. Most observers had focused on a proposal to raise premiums on military retirees younger than 65 that would be from $460 a year to as much as $2,048 by 2017 if they're receiving more than $45,000 in retirement pay. But that change is only part of a broader proposal that could weaken TRICARE and force many veterans into health exchanges and Medicaid. Now, I predicted this all along. I said they're going to make it so that we end up defaulting. Those of us veterans that are qualified as retirees are going to default into a health exchange / Medicaid. And those are going to be crappy. In fact, I've got a quote, and this will come into play later on. This is why I'm bringing this up. But a quote from a relative of mine in Canada. If your medical condition is not life-threatening, you will wait, and it can be a long wait. I also know many Canadians that have gotten surgeries, particularly for knees, that have gone wrong, gone bad, because they're so much trying to cut corners. You know. Let's see. Additionally, the administration wants to steer more TRICARE patients into military treatment facilities. In other words, on-base clinic. But we're closing more bases and reducing the number of clinics. Those clinics already have long, long wait lists. I mean, it's already Canada here for veterans. The administration is also cutting payments for private doctors who participate in TRICARE. Those who do participate are already paid much less than they get in private health care plans. In fact, they're turning TRICARE patients away. They don't want to take them. They're getting Medicaid-level payments. I know somebody right here in South Florida that I'm working with to help get some surgery that doesn't have any money, and the doctor who was helping this young lady initially with a dental surgery did some of the surgery under Medicaid, but when the big surgery came, the big surgery that was going to cost a lot, wouldn't do it because Medicaid doesn't pay enough. So this kind of stuff's already going on. This is where we're shoving our vets. This is where we're shoving our wounded warriors, people who come back missing a leg, missing an arm, missing part of their head. They're not going to work in the military anymore. They're out on a disability, maybe a full disability. But the TRICARE system that was supposed to take care of them, that is taking care of them, is gradually sliding away. And this president is not living up to his promise. So if you want to read more about the article, it's very disturbing. And I've been predicting this since I was running for Congress back in 2009 or 8. I think I actually started 2008. So this is an ongoing problem, and it's only getting worse, only getting worse. So if you get a chance to talk to your representative or even possibly senator, bring this up. This is unacceptable, unacceptable. Do you have any thoughts on that article if you got a chance to read it, Paula?
I'm sorry I didn't, Tom.
That's okay. That's okay. Well, just based on what I said, what do you think about that?
Be quite honest with you, Tom. I wasn't paying too much attention.
Hey, at least you're honest. I like your honesty. Okay. Well,
I was surfing web for something else. I apologize.
Not a problem. Not a problem. Well, listen, I spent hours today looking at and listening to the testimony, all of the testimony that was presented before the Supreme Court yesterday afternoon, 2 hours worth. And I'm going to boil this down to you, what the government's really saying. This is the bottom line. The bottom line. I'm summarizing it. So, no, I'm not putting words in their mouth. I'm just summarizing what I got out of 2 hours of listening to the liberal judges and the government trying to make their case. Here's the deal. We have a problem in the healthcare market, an existing market that does involve a lot of interstate commerce. We have a problem, and that is cost. And there are people that will enter this market because they need health care. They need to be taken care of when they're ill, injured, hurt, etc. But they can't pay. So we've got an existing commerce market where we have too many people that just can't pay. The solution is to control a different market. The insurance market, the health insurance market, because they're inextricably linked, as one of the liberal judges had said. So the solution is to not control the healthcare market. In other words, when you show up and can't pay, we penalize you, tax you, or those that can pay, we throw a bunch of taxes on what you are paying every time you pay to pay for those who can't. The solution is to get everybody insurance. So that's what we're going to control, is the health market. And the argument that the liberal justices were making is that everyone is in this market, even if they're not in the market. Now, did you hear what I said, Paula? Everybody's in the health insurance market, even if they're not in the health insurance market. In other words, if you don't have health care insurance, it doesn't matter. You're in that market, because by not having health insurance, you're affecting the rates. Now, I'm going to get to the lunacy of this in a moment. With a couple audio bites, and explain to you that they're trying to have their cake and eat it too. In other words, they're saying, we got people that can't afford it, and we're going to put them in the market, and then they're going to pay for insurance, and now that spreads the wealth around. Wait a minute, you just said they can't afford it. Either they can or they can't. oh, okay, they can't afford it the way it is today, but we're going to make it really cheap so they can't afford it. Well, that's just not going to cover health care costs. So they're going to have to be subsidized, so costs are going to go up. But anyways, let me get back to the bottom line here. So let me back up. There's a problem in the health care market. And the way Congress is going to solve that problem is they're going to take control of the health insurance market. And you're going to hear it in one of the audio bites. The lawyer for the government says, what are we trying to control here? He's asked. We're trying to control the health insurance market, not the health care market, the health insurance market, so that you will be able to pay for your health care. Okay, and since everybody's going to eventually need health care, we're only getting you to pay up front for something that you're going to have to pay for later on anyways. So we're not forcing you to buy something. We're just getting you to pay for something that you're going to pay for later on. So you're going to pay for it before you actually need it. Now, Paula, I'm going to give you a quick analogy here. I'm going to give you my religion church analogy. It's not the best in the world, but not everybody needs to go to church. Now, let's just exclude atheists. Don't worry about the atheists, okay? Don't worry about the atheists. But everybody else. You know, when there's a really tough point in your life, most people will go to church to seek some kind of counsel and solace. Loss of a loved one, hard times, the need to repent about something, on and on. But many people aren't going to church today. And that is affecting the bottom line of the churches. Churches do engage in lots of interstate commerce. Although they're nonprofit, they engage in a lot of interstate commerce. They own buildings, and they buy things, and they sell things, and they do everything to help provide for the poor. They do a lot of great things. So most everybody that is religious is going to need religion sometime on down the road. So why doesn't the government say, you must join the church and pay tithing right now, because when the time comes when you really need some blessings from above, well, you've already paid for them. I mean, there's no end to this. And when we get to the last soundbite, which is Chief Justice Roberts, what I call opening a can of worms, that's really what he's getting at. Where is the end of this? But he takes a unique take on it, one that I did. Didn't say it quite the same way in the article I wrote a year ago. But he says, where does this stop? And you know, everybody's saying, well, where does this end? Where does this end? He's not saying where does this end in a different market. In other words, what other markets? Where does this end within healthcare? You've opened the door to now control all kinds of things. And we'll get to it. We'll get to it. But so that's the bottom line. We got a problem in healthcare, so we're going to make you buy insurance. That's our vehicle for solving the problem in healthcare. And here's the line of reasoning this lawyer kept using, Paula. He said, the government has every authority to regulate the health care market, big interstate commerce market. So what they've decided to do is make you buy insurance, although I have a soundbite of him saying that they're not making you buy anything. But they're going to make you buy insurance because they've decided that if everybody has insurance, then the cost will go down. And I'm going to prove to you that the cost will actually go up. Okay, so the other thing is, yesterday we talked about burial. Everybody's got to be buried. And he made the comment that, well, you know, if you can't afford to be buried, you don't have burial insurance, then the state's going to pay for it. So apparently the government doesn't mind if taxpayers have to shoulder a burden. It's just as long as consumers don't. As long as consumers don't. Well, taxpayers are consumers. And if my taxes go up because a lot of people are dying and they can't afford to be buried, then I have less disposable income to consume with. Taxpayers are consumers, consumers are taxpayers. But apparently, they don't care about the states paying for things. They care about individuals, consumers paying for things. All right, so let's get to our first lovely sound bite. It's only 23 seconds long. This is what I call 40 million people without.
Congress's economic regulation produces whatever they are. I think Congress can do something to counteract them. Here, requiring somebody to enter the insurance market.
It's not a problem of Congress's creation. The problem is that you have 40 million people who cannot get affordable insurance through the means that the rest of us get affordable insurance.
Two very interesting things there. Justice Alito brought up the fact that, or maybe it was Scalia, one of those two, that Congress, the government, creates problems by overreaching, overregulating the health industry, the healthcare industry. And now, in order to solve the problems it created, it's going to implement more control. That's what he was getting at. Now, the lawyer is saying, no, it's not Congress's, it's not government's fault. The problems we have nothing to do with government. He said, we've got 40 million people, and did you notice, Paula, he said people, not Americans, he said people, who cannot obtain health insurance like the rest of us. Now, that's an outright lie. That's an outright lie. All of the studies, all of the numbers, where this number comes from, the study that the libtards constantly use, 40 million, it originally was 50 million, now they're down to 40 million, because they think they're excluding illegal immigrants. That still includes them. The 40 million number comes from here. You've got 10 or 12 to 15 million illegal immigrants and 20 million Americans that can purchase health care but choose not to. A lot of them would be young people, but a lot of them are older people who just choose not to purchase health care. So the reality is 20 million of the 40 million he's talking about could actually purchase health care. In fact, many of the illegal immigrants probably could afford to, but they're trying to stay under the radar. So how many people does that leave? That leaves around 5 to 9 million people that don't have health care and can't actually afford it. So it's a lie when he says this. But I'm going to tell you what, Paula. Let's assume that the 40 million people really can't. And let's just say they're all Americans, too. Let's just say there are no illegal immigrants in there, no people from other countries, because quite honestly, we have to start giving free health care insurance to illegal immigrants. Well, why don't we go to the continent of Africa and start taking care of all the poor people on that continent? I mean, it's the right thing to do, isn't it?
Yeah.
Just because people that aren't citizens reside in this country, what's the difference between them and a poor person that doesn't have insurance in Honduras or Haiti? Okay. So, but let's assume for a minute that really the 40 million people can't afford it. Okay. So we're going to put 40 million people into the insurance pool. Now, his argument is, by putting everybody in the insurance pool, we spread the costs around and the costs go down. But wait a minute. Those 40 million people can't afford it. He just said it. So what does 40 million people going into the insurance industry do to your and my insurance costs, Paula? Makes them go up. Yeah. It goes up. And if they can't afford insurance, can they afford a copay? No. So every time they have to go in, they're poor, they're designated as poor, and the president said there's got to be a poor exemption. So all of these people that can't afford it, he's just proven they can't afford it, so they're not going to be making insurance payments, and they're not going to be making copays. You and I are going to be subsidizing all of that. So our health care costs, our insurance costs, rather, will have to go up. They have to go up. Now, here's something very important that we've learned from the military. Every military doctor I've ever spoken with, and Dr. James DeJerome, who wrote a book on reforming our healthcare system, was in the military and a doctor in the military, and he makes this point in his book. His book is The Cure for the American Healthcare Malady. He makes this very important point. He said before TRICARE, in other words, where retirees could have outside healthcare off of the base, but they do pay a copay. Small, but they pay a copay. When they could come into the clinic on base and it didn't have to pay a thing, they'd come in for anything and everything. They wouldn't come in for preventative care. They'd come in if they had a little cough. He would see people that had no business being in that clinic. Oh, my back aches a little bit. Because it was free. If you suddenly said it's $10 every time you come in here because you have a cough, you think you're missing one of your one hair out of your eyebrow, your back aches a little bit, you stubbed your toe. If all of a sudden you told retirees it's $10 every time you come in here, that would clear out the clinic literally. So what's going to happen, Paula, when 40 million people who can't afford it, so they're not paying it, and can't afford a copay, they're getting it completely free, they're going to be going in, hey, it's free. I stubbed my toe today. Oh, I hurt my thumb. You know, I want workers' compensation. Let me come into the clinic, though. That is not free. You and I have to pay for that. Not only are we paying the insurance portion, we're paying the copay. And not only are we paying the copay, but the doctor's got to get his pay. And these people aren't paying into the system. So it's going to make our health insurance costs skyrocket, Paula. Skyrocket. 40 million people. First of all, it's a lie. But let's go along with him and just agree with him on this. He has just told us his whole argument is by getting everybody in the insurance pool, costs will go down. But the 40 million he's talking about getting in to participate that aren't participating are going to drive the costs up because they don't have any money. So he can't have it both ways. either they can afford it or they can't. If they can't afford it, then it's going to drive everybody else's costs up. All right. And then we get back to the way it is in Canada and my recent visiting Canadian relative. If you're healthy, you're okay. But if you get ill, and it's not good, but not life-threatening, you've got a long way ahead of you. Okay, next soundbite, covering what you don't need. Robert starts off with this, and then Alito jumps in. And listen carefully toward the end. This is, unfortunately, 3 minutes long, but it's good, where the lawyer says that young people are going to be subsidizing old people. He admits young people will be subsidizing old people.
But it's critical how you define the market. If I understand the law, the policies that you're requiring people to purchase involve must contain provision for maternity and newborn care, pediatric services, and substance use treatment. It seems to me that you cannot say that everybody is going to need substance use treatment or pediatric services, and yet that is part of what you require them to purchase.
Well, it's part of what the statute requires the insurers to offer, and I think the reason is because it's trying to define minimum essential coverage because...
Yeah, but your theory is that there is a market in which everyone participates because everybody might need a certain range of health care services, and yet you're requiring people who are never going to need pediatric or maternity services to participate in that market.
With respect to what insurance has to cover, Your Honor, I think Congress is entitled to latitude in making the judgments of what the appropriate scope of coverage is. And the problem here in this market is that you may think you're perfectly healthy and you may think that you're not, that you're being forced to subsidize somebody else. But this is not a market in which you can say that there is an immutable class of healthy people who are being forced to subsidize the unhealthy. This is a market in which you may be healthy one day and you may be a very unhealthy participant in that market the next day, and that is a fundamental difference. And I was posing,
which is that doesn't apply to a lot of what you're requiring people to purchase. Pediatric services, maternity services. You cannot say that everybody is going to participate in the substance use treatment market, and yet you require people to purchase insurance coverage for that.
When Congress is enacting economic regulation here, it has latitude to define the attributes of essential coverage. That doesn't seem to me implicate the question of whether Congress is in engaging in economic regulation and solving an economic problem.
Are you denying this? If you took the group of people who are subject to the mandate and you calculated the amount of health care services this whole group would consume and figured out the cost of an insurance policy to cover the services that group would consume, the cost of that policy would be much, much less than the kind of policy that these people are now going to be required to purchase under the Affordable Care Act?
Well, while they're young and healthy, that would be true, but they're not going to be young and healthy forever. They're going to be on the other side of that actuarial equation at some point. And, of course, you don't know which among that group is the person who's going to be hit by the bus or get the definitive diagnosis.
You take into account that some people in that group are going to be hit by a bus. Some people in that group are going to unexpectedly contracts or be diagnosed with a disease that is very expensive to treat. But if you take their costs and you calculate that, that's a lot less than the amount that they're going to be required to pay.
Okay, so some interesting things here. First of all, Paula, I do have coverage to cover me in case I'm hit by a bus. It's called burial service coverage insurance. that guy was stupid, hit by a bus. I believe that was Alito towards the end, and he was right. The amount of money that you're going to have to pay to cover all these things that you're not capable of ever needing is going to drive your cost up unless you were able to just purchase insurance that covers what you know you're going to need. For example, Paula, he kept going to this, well, you're not always going to be healthy. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about, can I purchase health insurance that I need for me? Versus everybody else, and then have to cover everybody else for stuff I'll never, ever need. Well, you know, you're not always going to be, here's my example. So, Paula, I'm healthy. I think I'm healthy right now. But tomorrow I wake up and find out that I need a hysterectomy. Oh, my gosh. Good thing I had coverage for that. Wait a minute. I'm never going to need that. Okay, you, tomorrow, find out that you need prostate surgery. Wait a minute. That doesn't apply to you. That's what they were trying to get at. Why are you forcing people to buy stuff? There's a reason you're forcing people to buy stuff. The states already do this. The states already do this. We're forcing people to buy coverage for things they'll never need so that we can get them to pay, help pay, for people that will need it. So in other words, when those people actually need something, their costs are lower. We are subsidizing them with things that they're going to need that I will never need. And that was their question. Why are we covering people for things they don't need? But one of the other things that he said was he tried to deflect that, this is not Congress mandating that you have to have all this coverage. If Congress mandated the insurance companies to offer these things. Oh, you mean all of the coverage that I get that I'll never need, they're required to give it to me. I don't have to use it, but they're required to give it to me if I were to need it, but I don't. What, for free? When an insurance company says we're going to cover all these things, whether you need them or not, it costs me more money. Here's a perfect example. In the state of Florida, there are 44 mandates on health insurance that you purchase in Florida. Besides just what the insurance company wants to offer you and you get to choose, those mandates, I have to pay for those. Each mandate raises the cost of my insurance 1% to 5%. So, for example, smoking cessation, substance abuse, Justice said, maternity care, prenatal, postnatal, on and on and on, stuff that I'm never going to need, but I've got to pay for it because the state mandated it. Now, quite honestly, the state has that latitude. The federal government does not. But the federal government is doing that, is mandating that. That's what those mandates are, that you have to buy this. So that's where they're asking, why? Why are you doing this? And then Alito goes in and says, you know, if you add up everything that people really are going to use, it's going to be a lot more, it's going to cost them a lot more to cover all of that stuff than just what they're going to need. And the vast majority of people only need what they know they need. If you've got a family, then you need pediatric coverage. And I don't need pediatric coverage right now. My family doesn't need prenatal and postnatal and maternity care and on and on and on. We don't need that right now. But why am I paying for it? Because I'm subsidizing people that do. And that's the point they're getting at. You're forcing people to buy something they don't need. How is that constitutional? And then he went on to actually say, well, the Congress wasn't trying to solve an economic problem because we don't want Congress getting in controlling the economy. That's precisely what they are. They're controlling an economic problem. All right. Let's go to the food comparison. This is a good one. It's only 40 seconds long. And I can't remember who brought this one up, but I've got an article, a great article that goes in and basically debunks and tears apart this lawyer for the government's reason why food, controlling food versus health care, are two different things. So here we go.
But you never know whether you're going to
Could you
that
define
person.
The market? Everybody has to buy food sooner or later. So you define the market as food. Therefore, everybody's in the market. Therefore, you can make people buy broccoli.
No, it's quite different. It's quite different. The food market, while it shares that trait that everybody's in it, it is not a market in which your participation is often unpredictable and often involuntary. It is not a market in which you often don't know before you go in what you need, and it is not a market in which if you go in and seek to obtain a product or service, you will get it even if you...
What he was saying there at the end is, if you go into a grocery store and you need food but you don't have money, you're not going to get it. And I'll get to exactly why. Think food stamps. I don't have the money to buy it, but with government help, food stamps, then I do get it. So this is identical. But anyways, again in the American Spectator, Obamacare's preemptive regulatory strike by Andrew Klein. This came out today. So what that lawyer just said was food is not the same as health care. And here we go. I just pulled a couple paragraphs out of his article. It isn't. The left claims the food market is exactly the kind of market Verrilli said it was not. Have you ever heard of food deserts? Those are places where liberals say people cannot access healthy food. Rural areas and inner cities are examples of places where the left claims government needs to intervene to ensure access to healthy food. That's why Los Angeles banned new fast food restaurants in some low-income neighborhoods. If the type of food you consume is determined entirely by what nearby commercial vendors offer, then your participation in the food market is, by definition, often unpredictable and often involuntary. Why do we have government nutrition guidelines, government-mandated postings of nutritional information, including, in some places, nutritional information printed on menus, if the food market is not one in which you often don't know before you go in what you need? And what are food stamps, if the food market is not a market in which, if you go in and seek to obtain a product or service, you will get even if you cannot pay? All of Verrilli's attempted justifications for insurance mandate could very well apply to food as well as healthcare. Arguably, they could apply to transportation and many other markets too. Even if those conditions did not exist in any other market, the government could create them by doing to another market what it did to healthcare, cause untenable economic conditions via a myriad of ill-conceived regulations. And that was what the other Chief Justice was talking about earlier. I think it was Scalia, when he said, government caused these problems to begin with, and now it's going to fix it with more regulation and more control. Isn't that interesting, Paula? The government causes problems, and then that's their excuse for now taking more of your liberty and regulating you even more. So I thought the food comparison was a very, very good one, and that article really, besides just what the justices were talking about, really highlights that this lawyer is completely wrong. The problem is this opens the door, because I can guarantee you this, Paula, if this passes a year from now or 2 years from now, the government's going to be in there arguing, oh, healthcare is just – or food is just like healthcare. We need to control food and regulate that to the degree that we're regulating health insurance and healthcare. And the justices are going to hear counterarguments saying, but wait a minute. You said 2 years ago that the food market is not the same. Ah, we changed our mind on that one. It's opening Pandora's box. Okay, next one is only 13 seconds. Not really forcing you to buy something. Let's just listen to this one.
The question is there a limit to the authority that we're advocating here under the commerce power? And the answer is yes, because we are not advocating for a power that would allow Congress to compel.
Could you just say, before you move?
You got cut off there by one of the justices, but what he's saying at the end is we're not advocating a power that would allow Congress to compel you to buy something. Wait a minute. Aren't they compelling us to buy health insurance? This is their convoluted way of thinking, Paula. They believe that they're not compelling you to buy health insurance. They're just providing a way to pay for health care and pay just in a different way than you would if you paid on the spot. You're just paying up front. So he said it right there. We're not advocating Congress has the authority to make you buy something except health insurance. So now the next one is one of the justices' argument was that you're already in the market, as I said earlier. You're already in the market. So whether you're in the market or not, if you're not buying health insurance, you're affecting the market. That means you're in the market, even though you're not in the market. See, this is their convoluted way of thinking. Up is down and down is up, even when down is down and up is up. So this lawyer for the plaintiffs, for the states, he gives us a little lesson on Madison and the Commerce Clause. This is
not one that anything turns on that. Because if the government decided tomorrow that they've come up with some private companies come up with a great new wonder drug that would be great for everybody to take. It would have huge health benefits for everybody. And, by the way, also, if everybody had to buy it, it would facilitate economies of scale, and the production would be great, and the price would be cheaper, and force everybody in the healthcare market, the actual healthcare market, to buy the wonder drug. I'd be up here making the same argument. I'd be saying that's not a power that's within the commerce power of the federal government. It is something much greater, and it would have been much more controversial. That's one of the important things. In Federalist 45, Madison says the commerce power, that's a new power, but it's not one anyone has any apprehension about. The reason they didn't have any apprehension about it is because it's a power that only operated once people were already in commerce. You see that from the text of the clause. The first kind of commerce, Congress gets to regulate is commerce with foreign nations. Did anybody think the fledgling republic had the power to compel some other nation into commerce with us? Of course not. And in the same way.
Okay, that's an argument that I've made for years now. The Commerce Clause says to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states. How does it go from a process of negotiation with foreign nations to all of a sudden brute force among the states? How does it do that? It doesn't. Second of all, we have to remember the word commerce means a financial transaction. The Commerce Clause does not say that the federal government has the authority to regulate commerce, interstate commerce, commerce among the states, as well as anything it affects. But that's what they're doing. They're saying, well, if we can regulate the commerce, the financial transaction, we can regulate the car and the handshake and the phone call and everything else in between. Commerce is a financial transaction. It's not the market. Otherwise, they would have said that. They would have said the federal government has the authority to regulate markets and industries that span across several states. They didn't say that. They just said the financial transaction, period. But the liberal judge argument is it doesn't matter if you're engaged in commerce. The fact that you're not engaged in commerce affects commerce. The Constitution doesn't say what affects commerce. It just says commerce, period. That means something that's already occurred or in the process of occurring. So doing nothing affects markets. Let's take an example that I like to use, life insurance. And tell me if this sounds, Paula, any different than the argument for regulating healthcare insurance. Paula, we've got a problem. 40 million people can't afford life insurance. And there is a cost shifting of burial, bill payments. Hey, when you default on your bills because you died and there's no money to pay off your bills, who eats that? The consumer, not the taxpayer, the consumer. Your dependents and their care, et cetera. Now, we know that age affects cost. In other words, the older you are, the more it costs to have life insurance. So if we can get more young people into the insurance industry, the life insurance industry, people who don't need it right now, that'll help drive the cost down. We'll spread the wealth. We'll spread the cost around. Everyone's going to die someday. And your dependents and your family suffer, consumers suffer, the community suffers, but with insurance, there will be more money in the economy. So I guess the government can make us all buy life insurance. Is there any difference at all between life insurance and health insurance? Oh, there could be some astronomical costs associated with not having life insurance. You leave behind a wife and 2-3 young kids. Man, that puts a burden on family members, the community, state, federal government, and it affects the kids. It's how are they going to grow? You know, are they going to be able to go to college and other things? Are they going to have to get a job as soon as they're old enough to get a job and drop out of school? Huge effects by not having life insurance. So we're opening Pandora's box here to the government forcing us to buy all kinds of things for all the same excuses they're using for health care insurance. Now, the next one is that this lawyer makes is the every industry argument, and it's really what I just kind of showed you there, that this argument they're using to force us to buy health care can be used for any other industry out there.
In the market in the sense that they're creating a risk that the market must account for.
Well, Justice Kennedy, I don't think that's right, certainly in any way that distinguishes this from any other context. When I'm sitting in my house deciding I'm not going to buy a car, I am causing the labor market in Detroit to go south. I am causing maybe somebody to lose their job and for everybody to have to pay for it under welfare. So the cost shifting that the government tries to uniquely associate with this market, it's everywhere. And even more to the point, the rationale that they think ultimately supports this legislation, that, look, it's an economic decision. Once you make the economic decision, we aggregate the decision. There's your substantial effect on commerce. That argument works here. It works in every single industry.
So there you have it. I mean, could it be any clearer than that? You know, I've given you some examples. Others have given examples. But these same arguments can and they will. Once the door has been opened, all the government has to say is, hey, you let us do it over here. How come not over here? It's the same argument, same excuses. And it's going to be very hard for the court to say no. And that's precisely what Justice Roberts says in the last sound clip that we have, which I think is the best one of the day. It's one you're not going to hear in the mainstream media. They're not going to talk about it because it's just too powerful. Now, Scalia makes a really powerful point about something. about taxing. A lot was talked about the federal government's or Congress's ability to tax, and it's taxing power. Sometimes it's taxing power, like if you have to buy a license for something or a fee. You have to pay a fee for this and that. It's been argued in the past, even back when Alexander Hamilton Madison were arguing about, you know, what is a direct tax on somebody. In other words, if you buy a car and you have to pay a tax on that, is that a direct tax or an indirect tax? And they argue. So that's been going on around a long time. There was a lot of that talk. But this is a unique look at the whole concept of taxing us from Justice Scalia.
So you're saying that all the discussion we had earlier about how this is a one big uniform scheme and the Commerce Clause, blah, 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 it really doesn't matter. This is a tax, and the federal government could simply have said, without all of the rest of this legislation, could simply have said, everybody who doesn't buy health insurance at a certain age will be taxed so much money, right?
It used its powers together to solve the problem of the market not providing
affordable
coverage.
But you didn't need that. You didn't need that. If it's a tax, it's only raising money is enough.
It is justifiable under its tax power. If I may reserve the balance of my time.
He said extraordinary there at the end. So what he's saying is Congress has the ability to tax us. Why didn't it just tax us? This guy makes, the government judge makes a huge case about how the penalty is really just a tax. Yeah, it's called a penalty, but penalties have been found to fall under the taxation power. So Scalia is saying, well, then why didn't he just tax us? Why not avoid all this controversy and just tax everybody? Say it's a tax, just like Social Security and Medicare. It's a tax to provide something for people that we believe everybody needs. Well, he can't answer that question. His answer was, well, they pulled together a lot of different things, you know, the Commerce Clause, what he's saying, and this and that and the other thing to piece it all together. But it all ends up being controversial. So why not just tax us? Why couldn't you just do that? There's a reason they didn't want to just tax us. Because it's a power grab. Because it opens up the door to what we're going to listen to next. It opens up the door to doing all kinds of other things. We already know that Congress can tax us on anything and everything just about. In almost any way they want. That's not enough for them. They need more power. So let's listen to Chief Justice Roberts, and as he discusses what I call opening a can of worms. This is about a little under 3 minutes. Very good, though. This sums it all up. Probably the best discussion there was. And I think if anything is going to sway the majority of justices to say this is unconstitutional, this line of reasoning right here is it.
Is your argument limited to insurance or means of paying for health care?
Yes, it's limited to insurance.
Well, now, why is that? Congress could, once you establish that you have a market for health care, I would suppose Congress's power under the Commerce Clause meant they had a broad scope in terms of how they regulate that market. And it would be going back to Lochner if we were put in a position of saying, no, you can use your commerce power to regulate insurance, but you can't use your commerce power to regulate this market in other ways. I think that would be a very significant intrusion by the court into Congress's power. So I don't see how we can accept your – it's good for you in this case to say, oh, it's just insurance. But once we say that there is a market and Congress can require people to participate in it, as some would say, or as you would say, that people are already participating in it, it seems to me that we can't say there are limitations on what Congress can do under its commerce power, just like in any other area, all given significant deference that we accord to Congress in this area, all bets are off, and you can regulate that market in any rational way.
But this is insurance as a method of payment for health care services.
Doesn't
exactly.
Get it.
You're worried. That's the area that Congress has chosen to regulate. There's this health care market. Everybody's in it, so we can regulate it, and we're going to look at a particular serious problem, which is how people pay for it. But next year they can decide everybody's in this market. We're going to look at a different problem now, and this is how we're going to regulate it. And we can compel people to do things, purchase insurance in this case, something else in the next case, because we've accepted the argument that this is a market in which everybody participates.
Mr. Chief Justice, let me answer that, and then if I may, I'd like to move to the tax power argument.
Can I tell you what the something else is, so while you're answering it? The something else is everybody has to exercise, because there's no doubt that lack of exercise caused causes illness, and that causes health care costs to go up. So the federal government says everybody has to join an exercise club. That's the something else.
No, the position we're taking here would not justify that rule, Justice Scalia, because health club membership is not a means of payment for consumption of anything in a market.
And, right. That's exactly right. But it doesn't seem responsive to my concern that there's no reason, once we say this is within Congress's commerce power, there's no reason other than our own arbitrary judgment to say all they can regulate is the method of payment. They can regulate other things that affect this now conceded interstate market in healthcare in which everybody participates.
That's beautiful. You see the point he made, Paula, that once you say in order to regulate health care, we're going to make you buy health insurance, you can now say, oh, we have another problem, obesity. People eat too much. People don't exercise enough. And that's our new problem. And while one problem was we need to pay for this, the next problem is we need to reduce the payments to this. Because even though everybody has insurance now, if they're not healthy, insurance rates are still high, and healthcare costs are still high. So we fixed the payment part. Now we're going to fix the reduction part, the reducing of the high cost part. That's precisely what he's saying. So instead of using the argument, well, could you regulate this industry and regulate that industry, he's just simply saying you've opened the door to all kinds of new regulation within an industry that we have just declared you can regulate in any way you see fit. So you don't even have to go to another industry and use another example. I think it's brilliant. I think that is the linchpin right here of all the arguments. And unfortunately, you're not going to see that on TV, and nobody's going to talk about it because it's so simple and so easy to understand. But it shatters the government's assertion that we're just using this to fix a payment problem. Well, how about a cost problem? How about an additional cost problem? There are different cost problems. So we got a few minutes here, Paula, and what I'm going to do is read from this article, and I'm just going to read two items. This was written at least a year or more ago, and I'm going to read to you what my vision of what would come on down in the future that these two justices have sort of painted with the food industry and the exercise industry. I'm going to start off reading the beginning of it because this is entitled The Rule of Law. It's not just about healthcare, but the rule of law. Government via the rule of law creates a society out of groups of people that generally have common goals and interests. And it's really the people that create the government. They create it in order to establish boundaries and limits for society so that the citizens may enjoy a more stable and secure environment to live in. And for the first time in history, our Constitution established boundaries and limits for government. The U.S. Constitution is the rule of law that our representative government is expected to live by when making laws for society to live by. Virginia republicanism, which was in large part the reason Thomas Jefferson was elected president, and when we say Virginia republicanism, it was states' rights, states' rights. According to Henry Adams, the author of History of the U.S., 1801 to 1809, this encapsulates Virginia republicanism, believed if government, either in its legislative, executive, or judicial departments, or any combination of them, could define its own powers in the last resort, then its will and not the letter of the Constitution was law. And thus, the essence of Virginia republicanism lay in a single maxim. The government shall not be the final judge of its own powers. Equally important to the rule of law, Adams noted, to this axiom of republicanism, the Federalist judiciary at that time, they were Federalists. They were all bigger government judiciary because they had all been appointed by previous two Federalist presidents, opposed what amounted to a flat negative. Chief Justice Marshall and his colleagues meant to interpret the Constitution as seemed to them right, and they admitted no appeal from their decision. So this is why Jefferson won. It felt that the government, particularly the Supreme Court, had gone too far. The government itself, Congress, passing laws that violated state sovereignty and the rule of law, which is the Constitution. So what happens if government does not follow the rule of law established for it? Is government doing it for the greater good and that makes it okay? Or are they doing it for their own benefit? What if society wants government to violate its own rule of law in order to provide something desired by the people? In order to answer these questions, we're going into the future and observe the results of government operating outside the document designed to protect society from that very government. As we arrive in 2030, we immediately get online and download major federal legislation and judicial rulings since 2012. Plenty of things catch our attention. March 4th, 2014, just 2 years from now, Congress passes H.R. 4590, the Healthy Life and Affordable Food Act. It has such a nice-sounding title, but we discover in its 3,800 pages that it's 3,800 pages long. No time to read it, so we search for an executive summary, and here it is. Number one, the price of food has skyrocketed, and the number of people on food stamps has quadrupled since 2011. Children and seniors are going hungry. Isn't that what we always hold up? Children and seniors from the liberal left. It's estimated that 70 million people in the U.S. are eating very unhealthy diets. This act will bring the price of food down, reducing rising health care costs. Again, it's the cost. We've got to figure out how to pay for this. From poor diets and malnutrition, and provide all Americans with the opportunity to enjoy a healthy diet. Number two, since we are all paying for these high food costs anyway and subsidizing those who can't afford to eat, the federal government will now manage the food supply from crop to grocery store. In order to increase competition with the big, bad, evil grocery chains that have escalated food costs, the federal government will establish grocery exchanges in every city. Number three, the Crop and Grocery Commission will be established to oversee all agricultural practices and grocery store management. This commission will report to the Crop and Grocery Commissioner, who will have final say in establishing necessary regulation. Four, each family residing in the U.S. will be evaluated by a local nutritionist in the newly established Department of Grocery to determine nutritional needs. A magnetic identification card will be issued to each household embedded with a predetermined grocery allotment which best meets the needs of each household. Each week, a member of the family can visit their local grocery store or one of the government food exchanges to pick up their weekly allotment of food. The identification card will be swiped at the checkout counter, and a runner will retrieve the groceries and bring them to the checkout lane. Five, requests for deviations from the predetermined food allotment must be forwarded to the Office of Crop and Grocery Commission no later than 90 days prior to the month requested. Requests will not receive a response. If approved, the requested deviation will appear in the grocery allotment for the requested month. Now, I got to tell you, I took all this stuff out of the Health Affordability and Patient Protection Act, Health Care Patient Protection Affordable Act. I just took it right out of there. I just changed the names around a little bit, but it's right there. Now, on August 3rd, 2014, 22 states joined a lawsuit initiated by the state of Iowa against the Healthy Life and Affordable Food Act, claiming the federal government does not have the constitutional authority to tell consumers what they cannot buy. In November, a California Federal Circuit Court judge, it's always California or D.C., rules that the government does have the right to tell consumers what they can't buy, since it had previously been established that the government can tell consumers what they must buy, particularly if it's for their own good. The Supreme Court upholds this ruling on the 1st of April, 2015. Notice the date, April Fools. Okay, February 12th, 2017, Congress passes H.R. 5687, the Healthy Lifestyles Act. This act requires all Americans to purchase a gym membership to ensure optimal health, body weight, and lower rising health care costs. Man, there's always rising health care costs. Oh, it's a – and like this lawyer for the government said, we're trying to figure out a way to pay for this. That's all. Just trying to figure out a way to pay for this. Well, here's their way. Government gym exchanges will be established to ensure competition and affordability. Americans will be required to attend a minimum of 2 weekly workouts where they will be weighed and participate in the exercise activity chosen for them by a local athletic commissioner. Any citizen that does not attend the minimum number of days or meet established weight and performance goals will be penalized a 2% tax on their next annual income tax return, just like in the Obamacare. From October 2017 to December 2017, five states passed laws making participation voluntary. In other words, you don't have to participate. On the 13th of February, 2018, a D.C. Federal Circuit Court judge rules that the 10th Amendment was never intended to apply to federal legislation, and on June 12th, the Supreme Court upholds that ruling. The five states do not rescind their legislation, but admit that everyone must now participate, although Section 389, Paragraph 14, exempts members of Congress from having to participate. Sound familiar? There's more, but I'm not going to read it. Maybe next week I'll read some more of this so you can get an idea where it ultimately goes. But does that not sound familiar about the debate that's going on? Hey, why can't we control food? Why can't we? And I just wrote two pieces of legislation that take text straight out of Obamacare and just change it from food and gyms. And you have the same thing and you have the same exact argument. There is no end to this. This is Pandora's box that allows the government to become a highly centralized all-controlling government, which was and is not the law of the land according to the Constitution. So, Paula, what do you think? Did I accomplish my homework assignment?
I think you accomplished that and more. I find that it's always an education when we are doing this show, and I hope that's what a lot of people are getting out of it. I know I am. Even though I'm silent most of the time, I would say 99% of the time, Tom, it's enlightening. It really is.
Well, you can always jump in at any time. I know I get going on a roll, but don't hesitate to jump in.
No, you know what? You've got your facts, and I like to hear what you have to say, and I'm sure the listeners do too, believe me.
Well, I appreciate that. And of course, unless you have something else you want to talk about on the subject or in the news, is there anything you want to talk about on the subject or the news?
Oh, no.
Okay. I know, it's overwhelming. Then let's do this. Take us out with our tribute to veterans and those that have given the ultimate sacrifice.
Well, continuing our series honoring the fallen, the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq have claimed the lives of more than 450 Americans, bringing the U.S. death toll to more than 6,300 since 2001. Five names I'll be reading from the list: Ricardo Ceros Jr., 24, Sean Patrick Charles, 40, Danny Chen, 19, James Michael Kristen, 29, and Dominic John Sierra Mitaro, 19. From the Military Times website, Army Specialist Ricardo Ceros Jr. lost his life on October the 8th, 2011, serving during Operation Enduring Freedom. He was 24 years old from Salinas, California, and he was assigned to the 2nd Battalion, 75th Ranger Regiment, stationed at Joint Base Lewis-McChord, Washington. He lost his life in Logar Province, Afghanistan, of wounds caused by small arms fire. He was mortally wounded by small arms fire when his unit was attacked by insurgents barricaded in a compound in Afghanistan's Logar Province. He graduated from Everett Alvarez High School in Salinas and the University of California, Irvine, before enlisting in the Army in 2010. The funeral was held in his Indiana hometown. Police cars, fire trucks, and about 60 motorcyclists escorted the hearse bearing his body from the Gary Chicago International Airport to the funeral home in Gary, Indiana. The 24-year-old lived there until he was 5, and his mother still lives there. To the individuals serving overseas, specifically the Navy, your families love and miss you dearly. We keep you in our hearts and in our minds. We hold you in our prayers every evening. Your families love and miss you dearly and want you home real soon.
Awesome, Paula. Well, thank you so much. Next week, we're going to have to be a little flexible. We may broadcast on Wednesday, may not, because I don't know if I'm going to be flying or not. Thursday off, and so we'll absolutely be broadcasting on Thursday. If we can broadcast on Wednesday, we're going to get Mark Vance, good friend of mine, constitutional expert, to review some of this stuff as well as some other things constitutional. Otherwise, on Thursday, I don't have a specific plan for the show. We'll see what's going on in the news, current events, and we'll take our unique perspective and look at that. And then, of course, on the 11th, we've got the OccupyParty.org. Go to OccupyParty.org. You can find out who they are. They're going to be on the show telling us about their party and why they're relevant and what their plans are for getting Occupy-type candidates elected in 2016, at least a presidential candidate. They may be working on candidates for this election, but they're not going to try and get a candidate going for this presidential election. Too late for that, they've determined. So they're going to work it, and see if they can get somebody elected in 2016. So it'd be a very interesting interview, and they will probably have folks calling in, and so we're going to make sure that we put the word out through all the Tea Party groups so that they can call in and chat with these folks and ask them some questions. So it should be a fun and rigorous, enjoyable broadcast. In any case, that's all I've got. Anything else, Paula?
No, that is it. You enjoy the rest of your week and your weekend.
I will. You too. Everybody have a great weekend. Paula, thanks as usual. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you all next week.
You're listening to The American Hour with Commander Tom Garcia on the USA Talk Radio Network.